Welcome to this week's segment of our Rock and Talk series, Roll On with Walter Crockett. All right, so off you go with Zonkeraz.
So Zonkeraz was big in Worcester. You know, they were really big in Worcester, and they got, I guess, I was at that time the last person to join it, you know, in that version of the band. They had started as a trio, then they added, and Spider would get up and do a little percussion, and added John Bass, Webster on bass, and then they added drums, then they had a roadie who played percussion, Mitch, and Dennis Wright played drums. He didn't like it much because he was a jazz drummer. Mm. If you saw him down at Circe's, he would be playing like really a outer space stuff, and he'd be the happiest man in the world. And when you saw him at Zonkeraz, he'd be kind of gritting his teeth because he's playing this, you know, stupid country. But it was really a meld of country and blues. You know, it wasn't too far from what Clean Living was doing, but it was doing. And we were pretty much the Worcester version of Clean Living, except Clean Living had greater success. They had a lot of success. We were very big in Worcester, though. You know, by the time, by 79, we were getting 500 people at the Last Chance Saloon on a Monday night.
Wow.
You know, and we'd played every Monday. It was a great time because there were lots of people who were young,
Yeah. You
know. But Clean Living had an even larger following than that, but I think they had more students out there. But it's very similar. They would come here and they didn't work much here because the people didn't know them, and we would go out there and everyone would scratch their head. So it was kind of strange.
Mm.
But I believe they played at Paul's wedding.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah. But it was a great time, interesting band with Paul. Sort of ran it like the capo, you know. He's an Italian guy, but he was very, very musical piano player, and not just a folk or blues type of person. He was more popish than that. And Ricky was very much a folk kind of blues, and he wrote great songs.
Thank you. beneath willow tree. One of my favorite pastimes. There's one thing I do like a little better, and that's being here on this track, Jack, telling you all about it. You know what I'm talking about? I'm gone fishing, Daddy, gone fishing, Mama, gone fishing, baby. Hey, y'all, I'm gone fishing. Grab my dog and go fishing. Get my rod and go fishing.
Really great songs. He had a beautiful voice. And then Joanne was like Bonnie Raitt, except she was Joanne. She had that much power when you saw her live. Their harmonies were excellent. And then they added John Webster on bass, and his harmony was he could sing along with Joanne if he wanted to. He goes up that high.
I was lucky enough to see you guys at Indian Ranch.
That was one of the later ones,
No, I don't know. Was it maybe 10 years ago or something like
that?
Yeah,
I think we had Cliff sit in with us on for a song, yeah. That was probably our last reunion, yeah. But in the day, when everybody was young and they were all dancing, and they were all dancing to original music, because Zonkerass did original music. Mm. You know, the only song that I can recall they didn't was like Over the Rainbow, which was Joanne's showpiece. They would dance, which is a real problem for most bands. If you try to play an original song in a bar, they want to hear the Stones or something, you know, or way back in the day they wanted to hear Jeremiah Was a Bullfrog, you know, or Stairway to Heaven. But with Zonkerass, they could do it because their songs were so good and it was infectious, and they caught the crowd at the right time, which is when the baby boom was in its going out time before... Yeah. They had to work too much, or when they were still just working early enough, they could still stay out late o'clock till 1 o'clock on Monday night and get up and work Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty, you get a little older and you get kids, you can't do that anymore. But they caught it right at that time, but it was really their talent that did it. And I was just a guitar player. I did add a little stage stuff, you know, that's what I do a lot. And Spider and I would do moves together, and that was part of the... part of the show too. I continued to write songs then, but they didn't do many because they had their own songs, you know. I got to say that at that time, their songs were better than my songs, generally speaking, not completely. But they had better voices too, so that made a difference. So it was really a unique experience. You know, a lot of the crowd is so old, so our reunions got smaller and smaller. We started doing them at Hanover, and then by the time we got to Indian Ranch, it was a smaller crowd, you know, because people move away. People don't like to dance as much when they get old, you know. They feel conspicuous. The great thing about it, people would dance, and there were a lot of women there, and guys come when women are there.
That's right.
And it was a woman-friendly band, and it made a huge difference. Now, a little bit later, not many years later, but got into the punk rock scene, and people started slam dancing, and it's just a bunch of guys on the floor because the women didn't want to be out there being hit, and it kills the scene.
Yeah.
You know, what really made those scenes is the romance.
Yeah.
But you can only catch that generally at a certain age. After that, you got to look at a family crowd or a nightclub crowd that's going out, you know, sitting down probably, you know. Mm. And so it's, though you guys are still playing to a lot of dancers.
When we play sometimes, yeah.
But it's tougher to do that twice a week in the same town, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
We were there at the right time.
How long was Zonkeraz active like this?
They started in 71 or 72, and they went till about 80, I think. I left them, Joanne left them in 76, which was a blow, and then we got Nancy Roach. And Nancy was real good. She didn't have Joanne's soulful... She had a real nice voice. But and then I left, and Nancy had left at the same time in 79. They made an album, but it was just past the cusp, you know what I mean, of the band.
I think there's a copy of it right there. I don't know if there's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's some real good songs on there, but it was a little... For me, it was a weird experience because they brought in this other lead guitar player, studio player. Who didn't play at all like I did. They wanted a more rock and rolly sound. Frank Carrillo. So that was a little odd. But I still played on them. And there's some songs I really like. They did bring in Crosby, Stills, and Nash's producer, who by this time was a cokehead. But he produced two songs, a couple of songs anyway. And they came out real good. One song I would recommend is Fishin'. And the other one is Drivin', two songs by Ricky.
Let's
recommend them partly because my guitar playing is real good. but they give you a better feeling of what the band sounded like. But I started being worried that they were going to actually make it because they had Twiggy's manager. Remember Twiggy, the model?
Yeah.
Justin de Villeneuve was going to manage them in Europe. And they were going to get to all these contracts. There were contracts lying around.
Holy
mackerel. And the contracts were, Zonkeraz was defined as Ricky and Paul.
Mm.
And I'm looking at it and I said, well, what does that mean for me, you know?
Mm.
Plus, I was in love by this time. I had met Valerie when we played Clark's Pre-Day. And we were together. We weren't married yet. We were already living together. And I started thinking, I'm going to go out on tour. I didn't want to screw up this marriage, you know, if we got married. But I knew, you know, if I go on tour for some length of time,
There's no way.
I knew who I was at the time, you know. I'm not that way anymore, but I was coming out of a rock and roll lifestyle, and I was going to blow this thing. Plus, I was a little concerned that maybe... What happened, though, instead was the album just flopped, and within the year you could buy it at Al Bum's for a dollar.
Mm.
And the band kind of carried on fumes for a little while, you know. This was before I left the band. And then I decided, you know, I didn't want to, I still thought there was some chance things would happen, but I wasn't as comfortable with it anymore. And so I called up Duke Levine and asked him if he'd... he was in high school. He was still 16. would he start a trio with us at the end of the year? This was beginning of 79, the end of 78. And Valerie had been singing with me in the kitchen of our three-decker over near Clark. And he said yes. You know, he was already been playing in several bands around town. I knew he was good. He could play acoustic, too. So we started practicing, and by... my last night with Zonkeraz was New Year's Eve of 78, and we started playing at the Blue Plate with this band, with me, Valerie, and Duke, acoustic.
And that was called?
That was called Crockett, and I decided to just use my name. Played there every week, then started playing in Tammany Hall, too, and gradually we added a bass player. At first, I don't think we paid Valerie because she didn't play all the songs, or we played her per song or something. Then we realized that she had actually paid for the van that we used to take the equipment.
Jeez.
I know.
Poor gal.
But you know, so she had to learn everything on the fly, the whole thing, you know, and put up with some pretty weird songs from me.
And she lived with you.
And she lived with me, but we got along great.
Oh, good.
That was the thing. As you know, it's not easy, but sometimes it is easy,
yep.
and then it's really great. So
yep.
We always got along well. On stage. I mean, there are times you're standing on stage later on that you say, smile, goddammit, smile. You know, you're smiling at the crowd and she's not, and you kiss at her between your teeth and stuff like that, you know. But it did not affect our, it was good. It was very lucky that way.
I remember being down at Sir Morgan's Cove. Oh, it was not Sir Morgan. No. What was it called?
Lucky Dog.
And there's a picture of Crockett, and it's you three with Dave Jakes and Bill McGilvery.
Right. So what happened is we started in 79. We even made a single, which I'll give you a copy of, which we used Tom Grignon, the Zonkeraz drummer, and John Webster on, and Ronnie Sloan, the harmonica player.
Oh,
I don't know
yeah.
if you remember Ronnie.
I do, yeah.
And that was a nice one. We gradually, you know, we played a lot. We were given guitar lessons at the same time. But gradually, and I wrote songs all the time because I had to, and I booked the band because I had to. So that's when I really learned to work. You know, this is starting in 79. You know, by that time I was 32 years old, going on 33. But I hadn't really learned to buckle down. I didn't have to. I didn't run Zonkeraz, you know. But I had to write the songs. I had to book the band, keep things together. So we added Dave Jakes after about a year. its first night, we were playing at Tammany Hall, and back before they expanded the room, you played it to the short wall, and he was sick, and he ran in to throw up the bathroom, but there was no drain on the sink.
Oh, God.
You can cut that part out.
No way am I cutting that out.
But that was our first night there. We played Tammany Hall, and we played there regularly, actually. We drew well. We played one time at the pub on Park Avenue, and James Gorgoris, this was earlier on in our career, shall I say, a jerk who wrote for the Evening Gazette music reviews. But at the time, their writers weren't into the new stuff, and it wasn't like it was that new. It was, you know, it's been around for 15 years or 20. But he wrote a glowing article about us in advance just based on my talking to him, without ever seeing us, right? And then Duke gets a cold, and we cancel a gig, our first gig at the pub on Park Avenue, and James Gorgoris writes about that. It's the difference between the real people who care and people who don't care, you know.
Oh, my God.
And, yeah, he savaged us. After that, we didn't let anybody not play when they were sick.
That's right.
If you can get out of bed, you're going to play. But Duke was like 16 still. No, yeah. He turned 17 by then.
Oh my God.
But he was a great guitar player. You know, he played great acoustic. He could play Doc Watson stuff. And his electric playing just grew by leaps and bounds. He was throughout the whole thing. So we added Dave. And I used to have a stomping board, and I think that's why I have neuromas in both feet now. But I had a piece of wood that I would stomp on the backbeat while we played before we got a drummer.
Oh, jeez.
So that people would dance. And now both of my feet are like, it's awful. But I still survive.
Yeah.
And then a year later after that, we added Billy on drums. And that took us to another level, and we went from being a folky kind of thing to getting into ska and a little bit, you know. I liked the Pretenders. There were some things of the new wave thing. I liked the Vapors, for example, very much. Pretenders, the English Beat, people like that. I didn't like all of it. Punk was not my thing. But even that, we did to do a few punkish things, humorous songs. And we were playing rock and roll, and we would do Chuck Berry stuff, or we would do things I had just written. We would do some countryish, some bluegrassy kind of things, because Duke could handle the entire range, and a lot of real straight kind of our own kind of rock and roll. But it would often have a lot of vocals on it, because I liked a lot of vocals with bass and stuff. And there's some of that on YouTube, which I will show you. And that went well. You know, we were playing 5-6 days a week for the last 2 years of our existence. It got to the point where Duke decided he wanted to go to music school. We'd done it for 4 years. You know, we didn't have a record contract yet. And so, and Val and I were thinking about having kids, you know. I couldn't replace Duke. You know, there was nobody.
No.
You know, I was playing lead guitar, too. I'm not a bad lead guitar player, but he was wonderful. And it made the whole thing, you know, and it made it possible for me to play what I play. And if I played particularly well on my solo, I would try to build it up so he'd have to take the emotional level higher, which he could, you know.
Yeah.
He can drive, it's like tugging on Superman's cape.
Yep.
You can still see on videos when he and Kevin are playing. I'll show you one sometime. There's a great one of them together where Duke is playing along. He plays a solo. Kevin takes it up a little bit. Kevin takes it up real hot, fancy country pick, and then suddenly Duke comes in and is like, yeah. And it was exactly the don't tug on Superman's cape thing.
Yeah.
You know, he's going to go wherever he has to go, and it was wonderful. So we just decided he would leave. This was like August. We had just made a tape with our newest, most, I don't know what you call it, new wavy songs, but we'd never released it. And because he decided to leave, so we took it through New Year's Eve, and we announced our farewell tour. And the crowds, which always get thinner in September for some reason or other, it seemed to me at the time, you know, and plus the audience, you know, the age group that goes out stays the same. Mm. So the people like you don't, many of them don't come out anymore. They got kids and everything. So it was tough. But once we announced our farewell tour, which took like 3 months, the crowds came back.
Yeah.
And we had a fantastic September, October, November, December. Ended up playing, we made $1,000 at the JC's on where we played every Tuesday night. And then we played Sir Morgan's Cove, and we broke the records there on New Year's Eve two nights in a row. And then it was over. So it was great. Except, you know, it wasn't great. I was pretty depressed because I had to get a job.
Yeah, and musically, what do you do after that?
I know. I know, you know, and, you know, that was the end of 1982, and I haven't had another lead guitar player since. It's just the way it is, you know. I did use Kevin with Duke on my album, but that was much later in life.
That was beautiful. That's Walter just picking up the guitar.
Yeah, you know, I wanted to make a little point more about Zonkaraz, which is those guys were really excellent songwriters and singers, and what they did was unprecedented in Worcester, certainly, which was get people to dance to original music. You know, and they played almost all original music all the time between Paul Vona's songs, which are a little more on the sophisticated side, sometimes Latin, Joanne's song, which were sort of country but also bluesy.
Oh,
she was very soulful. And Ricky Porter, who was just, he just had a beautiful spirit. He wrote gorgeous songs that either he or Joanne would sing. And that was hard to top, but it made it possible for them to succeed because they also had a beat. Even when there were just three of them, it was Paul's piano that kept it together and Rick's rhythm. And even without a bass player, the floor would be shaking. They broke the floor at this place, I can't remember the name of it, up in Paxton.
I just talk to my baby Lord on the telephone. He said, stop what you're doing, honey, please come home. I can't hold out. I can't hold out. Oh, no, no. I get the baddest feeling, baby, talking to you on the phone. Oh, my baby, don't you walk and fly. Don't you know, sweet baby, you're the reason why I can't hold out. I can't hold out. Oh, no. I get the sweetest feeling.
And the dancers broke the floor, and the blue plate floor would bob up and down. They ended up reinforcing it. And that was like as a trio, you know? So
wow.
They're packing the place. I saw them at Worcester WPI when I was in the Prairie Oysters, and we were playing like Jackson, Cambridge, and places around and doing pretty well. But these guys were like, the audience was full of beautiful women in long flowing skirts, and it was, you know, it was just what am I doing wrong? But they did that, and they really deserve credit for doing that, and that pretty much set me on the same path. Even though I was, you know, as old or older than most of them except Paul, the idea of playing the original music and not just doing covers. Mm. None of the bands that I ever played in did we do real covers to any extent. We would never do, say, a Beatles song just like the Beatles did it. You know, you wouldn't try to copy the solos, you wouldn't try to copy the arrangements or something. Except, you know, for I've Just Seen a Face, where you go bum 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 ba bum ba bum 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 bum. That solo, which is so classic you can forget it. But we wouldn't do much of that. We'd do more obscure stuff or Chuck Berry stuff, and we do it with their own. We did do in Crockett when we got into it. We played I Want You Back by the Jackson 5.
Oh, wow.
And the Duke sang that, and that was, you know, that was pretty much a cover, but we're not going to sound, you know, a five-piece band with two guitars, three guitars isn't going to sound like the Jackson 5's
yeah,
orchestra, you know.
Yeah.
But
make it your own too.
Yeah, but right. But so that was always our way. Mm-hmm. That we did find out in Crockett that you want to keep people dancing. It does pay to have. It made it much easier to have some stuff that they at least had heard slightly somewhere, mm-hmm. you know. And it had to have a beat. And that is why it was so good to have Billy McGilvery, who played in Crockett, and who later did all the reunions in Zonkeraz and played in the Shades. When Zonkeraz stopped playing, they became a new wave band, the Shades, for a year or two.
And that was with Rick Porter?
Yeah, and Larry Preston and everybody. And Billy joined them too. But Billy is like the master of the backbeat, and he's just, that's why I've always, if it's not there, you know, if you don't hit that 2 and 4, I just, you know, it doesn't move me, and it doesn't get people on the dance floor. And if you're playing bars and you can't get people on the dance floor, then you've got to know how to do that.
It needs the groove.
Yeah, it does. So he was great at that, and I've always stuck with him at the various times I've had drums, which haven't been a lot since, in the last 40 years whenever I do. And Billy's the guy, so... Yeah.
I'm trying to get him in on this show and tell his stories, and he's very reluctant.
I bet he is reluctant. He's a modest fellow.
Yeah.
But he's a great guy, and he's seen a lot of stuff. I know that. Mm. One other point I'd like to make about these bands is that all those guys from the Prairie Oysters, which started out back in 1970, 54 years ago, every one of those original guys is playing today in bands. Wow. Our banjo player, Mark Schultz, is Mark Schultz and the Wayne Rangers, and he plays in Philadelphia, in clubs, and it's straight bluegrass.
Wow.
And he's Jewgrass, too. He does his, minor key stuff. It's great. He's just a big old bluegrass guy, you know. He must be in his early 70s by now, I would guess. Yeah, he was just a couple of years behind me, probably mid-70s. Gee, he's old. But he's still playing. He's still leading the band. He's still getting good gigs. Rick Porter plays in two bands in Worcester right now, Rick Porter from Zonkeraz plays in his own band, just made an album. He's been around. He's never stopped playing.
Yeah.
Still writing songs. Tom Grignon, who was the drummer of Zonkeraz, went down to Nashville and became a Nashville country drummer for years and years and years. And on and on. Joanne is still singing, and she still sounds wonderful. Mm. And, she was inspiring. Mm. Inspiring to stand behind on stage and just to hear, because she had true soul.
Wow.
Very intelligent woman, but very soulful, like you just don't see that much. And she was great. So she's still playing. All the guys in the Prairie Oysters, like Rick Levine, is playing in the two bands around Worcester, the Mugwumps and Cosmic Slim,
mm-hmm.
Playing his finger-picking style. And that we played finger-pick and flat-pick with us in the Prairie Oysters when we were attempting to be a country rock band, which we were a country rock band. We gave it everything.
Yeah.
Bill Fisher plays all over town on bass to this day. Our drummer Bob Bloom was played with Ola Tunji, the African drummer, for 20 years or so, and now he gives drum things all around. And the same is true of my later bands, like Crockett. Duke's gone on. He's played with all kinds of people. He's out with Bonnie Raitt right now, and then he'll be out with Peter Wolf when he gets back, and Mary Chapin Carpenter. And he's a monster.
Yeah.
He's renowned in the music community. And Dave Jakes went to Nashville after Crockett broke up and spent 20 years with John Prine. How do I put it? It's very rewarding to see this. People are still at it these days. As an old person, you're not going to get famous if you're not already famous. There is no path. I think Boxcar Willie made it, but he was probably younger than me by 20 years or so when he seemed to be an old man. But you keep playing because you love the music, and it's in your heart. And you love the people around you who also dig it, the people in the audience who still come out, who understand what you're doing, who listen and come back. They're all part of the same community. And then the people in the other bands that you might have been rivals with.
Mm.
Over the years, that falls away, and you get people like, there. Back in the 70s, big bands were Fate and the Joneses, and then Mad Angel and Zonkeraz, American Standard with Cliff Goodwin. Paul Arrange was out there, and he's still out there playing right now. All those guys, the great majority of them are still. Mike Lynch was in Albatross. He's still playing in the Silverbacks.
Yeah.
All those guys in the Silverbacks come from a blend of musicians. And if you go down to Greendale's on any given night, you'll see people that you haven't seen in 20 years, but they're still out to see whatever band is playing. And that's...
I feel like, what's a band without an audience that cares?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's the whole point of it, is to go out and... So there's this huge community now in Worcester, and that made it great. And The other thing, you know, I talked earlier about WORC, because a lot of us as kids were listening to that station and then to WAAF. Mm. I didn't listen to AAF very much because it was the kind of rock I wasn't into by then, but I'm a good deal older than some of those people. And that it gave people a common background. So you get kids from all over the city, different neighborhoods, getting to know each other, playing in bands, and pretty soon you're all friends, and all your musical friends, the alligators, as Cab Calloway used to call them, the knowledgeable fans of music. You know who those are among your fans. You know which ones really get what you're trying to do and listen to other kinds of music. You can talk about music with them.
Yep.
It makes for a very rich life.
Mm.
And that somewhere along the line, I realized that was, it beats the heck out of money. You know, the money you got to have. It's a necessity, but music and love are riches.
Mm.
If you're lying in bed in the morning with the one you love, you're as rich as you can possibly be.
Yeah.
You know, there is no greater riches than that. And the same thing about getting out and playing music, which is in a sense like playing volleyball, where you're playing in a band and things are bouncing back and you're keeping the ball up in the air for the whole song, you know, and you're doing these amazing little things in between.
Yeah.
And sometimes, of course, you fall on your face, but
get sand in places you don't want it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there are things about Worcester that contributed to that too, and one of them was ORC and the radio stations, some of which are still going. You know, WCUW has been doing that for years and years, and WICN too, and more on the jazz side, but still they support folk and local stuff. And then before Reagan, you had Summer's World, and a little bit after Reagan came in, where they hired bands to play in the park and artists to play in the park and go into the neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And all those people, kids who wouldn't have gone out, who didn't have much money, were given exposure to it. And then you see them after that at Elm Park if you play a free concert. Mm-hmm. First Night, when they used to have First Night, if you play a free concert, you see people that you don't see in the clubs because they can't afford to be there.
Yeah,
that was a wonderful thing. I guess that's probably why I've stayed here all this time. You know, there was a time we considered, we should really go to Nashville because there's a lot of room for songwriters there. Actually, there's not much room, and you got to start out working as a dishwasher or something.
Yeah, but, paying to play.
But yeah, there are too many nice people around here, you know, and people are what it's all about, music and love.
Yeah, man.
So there's my lecture. I was thinking, you know, along the way there was a lot of... It's not like you don't feel it when you're not making it, you know, when you're not getting famous. And there's a lot of that. And I wrote this song, 1981 in Crockett, you know. I wrote, and it kind of captured the general, even though we were doing pretty well, we were playing a lot, you know, we were making a living, we were paying taxes on the music. We had a school bus that we drove around in. Still, it gets to you sometimes. And Valerie sang this on the record, but for good reason. When the rain falls like failure through the trees, and the cold November wind can't do a thing with the frozen leaves, and you try and you try, but trying don't make it right. You can take me easy tonight. In the sound of the highway, there's an echo of a song. And the more you want it, the more you get it wrong. And your dreams, sweet dreams, sip them farther out of sight. You can take me easy tonight. Oh, I can't help you if you're lost upon the way. If you're bound to leave in the morning, I can't make you stay. But if your soul wants shelter and your mind's too tired to fight, you can take me easy tonight. Then the guitar comes in, you know. But so that kind of gives you, you know, there's a lot of that. I was writing songs in 1975 about children so long, goodbye, you know. You know, how old was I then? I guess I was 29. You know, but I was feeling old and in the rock and roll world. Same thing a little later in Crockett, you know, by 82 I was writing songs. I'll be there in the wine and the wailing, carrying on. So you carry on, you know, that sort of thing. But then you persevere and you keep living. You wake up and you're still alive, mm-hmm. and you go on, you know. So once we started Crockett, you know, I decided to leave Zonkeraz and get a band with Valerie. I had discovered her in my kitchen on Elm Street, where I shared with another guy when I was in Zonkeraz. I discovered her. I didn't discover her there. I met her at Spree Day at Clark, but she was singing a song in the kitchen, and I said, wow, she's got a voice. You know, she was into kind of Judy Collins sort of stuff back then, you know, and folk stuff. I was ready to leave the band. You know, it was kind of our record. We made a record with Zonkeraz. It didn't really go anywhere, and Joanne wasn't in the band anymore. I decided I didn't want to take the chance of us becoming famous and then having to be stuck leaving Valerie. And so we started our own band, called up Duke, and he was 16 in high school, and he agreed to do it. So his first, we started like at the Blue Plate early in 1979 as a trio. I remember Zonkeraz had played there before, but they got too big for it. I filled a bag with my old shoes. We also had a blackboard in which I would write clever things. You know, I was doing everything possible to entertain people. Okay. It was me, Valerie, and Duke. And she, you know, she didn't even play on every song at first because she didn't know them all. And at first we paid her just per song she played.
Oh, that's nice.
And then we realized that she had paid for the Volkswagen bus that was driving us around. And Valerie had an aunt. Valerie was 10 years younger than me. I was 30 and she was 20 when we met in 77. But she once came to me and told me, well, I have a secret, you know, I don't know if I can tell you this. I thought, oh, geez, there's some terrible crime in her past.
Right.
Her secret was that her aunt, who had worked all her life for the public library in Philadelphia, worn two dresses, one dress and washed the other one, entire time. The spinster aunt had left her $20,000, which was a lot of money in 77, you know, and I thought, aha, how can I spend this? I said, well, that's not such a bad secret, you know, and we were just starting out with the band, and so we bought a Volkswagen, an old used Volkswagen bus that we could drive it around, which we did until we got a drummer, and then we bought a school bus a couple of years later. And we bought a house.
Wow.
For $17,000, putting $10,000 down.
Jeez.
On Maple Tree Lane. You know, it was incredible that you could buy a house for that at that time. And it needed a lot of fixing up, which we didn't do until 30 years later when it moved out. No, we did a little bit, but... So we spent that money quickly, but it got us started. The bag of shoes was so I could go on stage and dump them out. I was going to say, well, you know, Zonkeraz used to play here Saturday night, and it's going to be hard to fill their shoes, but here they are. And I poured the shoes on this.
Oh, my gosh. That's a lot of work for a bad joke.
I know. You got to work hard for a really bad joke. But we did things. I had a stomping board, like a little piece of plywood that I would do the backbeat with my foot, because we didn't have drums or bass at the time. So when I wanted people to dance or to just to feel it, I would go whamp, whamp, yeah, just on the 2 and 4. And our sound man hated that, George. We inherited Zonker as a sound man, George Weston. Yeah. It was a real character. He hated that. I think he took it out and shot it, actually. But then we added Dave Jakes on bass from the Black Apple Band. He was playing with Jimmy O'Neill, the guy who owned the bike store in Webster Square. And Dave joined us. We played that for a while. Then we got Billy McGilvery coming in from some other band. And then we were really cooking, mm-hmm, you know, the last couple of years. We were doing fine before that, but we were giving some guitar lessons in between and stuff like that. I could teach Stairway to Heaven, not the solo, but the whole little part there. Do, 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 do. It would take a month to teach the whole thing to a kid, so I didn't have to think of another song to teach. Yeah, but we eased out of that, and we started playing all the time and moved from a bluegrassy kind of country-ish thing into a totally eclectic thing that included like real even punkish songs and new wave songs and that were original. And it worked real well for the crowd that liked eclectic things. If you were there for the Stones, you weren't going to hear the Stones, you know.
Right.
You could hear stuff to dance to, and we did play for dances. I mean, we had to play for dancers because you got to do that in bars, you know, unless you're in a jazz bar or something where people are drinking cocktails and listening. But that's not what it was. And I loved that. You know, I love playing lead guitar or even rhythm guitar. But Duke was there. My job would be to, self-styled job, would be to play something that would make him have to play harder, you know, and he could always top you. Top you to this very day. It doesn't matter what you do, he's gonna top that. He likes to relax and play things that are sensitive and subtle. But if you need be, he'll go wild on you. And he did that a lot in those. He'd play the guitar with his teeth.
Some kids love to hug and kiss, some to fight. Some kids dream of paradise, some kids dream of food. Some kids hit the road on wheels, some in shoes. But no matter how you're doing, there's a kid inside of you who's gonna find you. And if he's dead and aspirated and you try to run away, he's gonna hide too. But if you stand up to your troubles, you'll be there from the devil right beside you. Sail on through, sail on through, take it to.
Play it with the microphone. We were jumping all around stage. We were extremely active. We would leap all at the same time. It was a very enjoyable band to be part of. And then we played from pretty much from Block Island, Martha's Vineyard, on up to Stowe and the ski areas. Ludlow was a strange little town. Hmm. It's in Vermont, but it was all the people from New Jersey, and it had a weird feeling to it. But we played all over and loved it, you know, had a great time. And then it was, you know, he was ready to go on, and we couldn't quite get a record deal, and you know, I was getting to the point where, you know, we were playing some gig, and this young girl who, before I met Valerie, I would have, you know, in my Zonker-ass days when I was single.
I don't know. Just spell it out for me.
Anyway, she comes up to me and says, "Oh, my father went to high school with you. He was in your class in high school." And I said, "Oh, gee.
Oh,
geez. You know, this is, yeah. I'm getting too old to rock and roll." You know? And that was what, you know, I was maybe 36.
Oh, geez, yeah.
You know? But it seemed like very old until you get a little older.
Yeah.
You know, now a quarter of my life is almost gone, as Crosby, Stills, and Nash sang. Actually, if I get a quarter more, I think I'll be slightly over 100. So that's what I'm aiming for.
Yeah, good.
So we went on, and I had to make a living. We quickly had a kid. Val kept giving guitar lessons, and then we had my son Jackson. Within months after we broke up the band, which we broke up at the end of 82, I got a job at the Telegram and Gazette. I was lucky. I started writing little sports things freelance and then music things freelance. And I even had a chance to interview Jerry Garcia, though that was never printed because I didn't know how to write back then. But our manager in the Prairie Oysters became friendly with Jerry and would see him all the time. And he got me an interview with Jerry when he was staying at the hotel that used to be down in Lincoln Square. I went in there and... Rhody took me in, and then Jerry comes like bopping in, a little guy, very friendly, talks to me. Then Rhody lays out two lines of coke and says, "Do you want any?" And I said, "No, I can't, you know, I've got to be sane." Later on, I realized that would have been the best coke I ever did in my life.
Yeah.
But coke never did anything for me except make me want more coke, you know.
Yeah.
So, no. But we talked for like 45 minutes.
Wow.
And I asked him questions, but like I wasn't a writer then. I hadn't started working on it. And it's tough when you're interviewing Jerry Garcia, you know, when he's talking to you. He said interesting things.
And were you taping it, or are you just writing, taking notes? Or
I was taking notes. Oh, yeah, I didn't tape
different.
It.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, he's across the floor out of the room. Bye-bye, and he's gone.
It was probably the coke.
But it was nice. But so I had to figure out how to write, you know, because it was the only thing left for me to do. And I had written letters to the editor, and it turned out that they hired me for the regional, you know, after I did a bunch of freelance stuff, they hired me for the regional offices, and I worked there in Fitchburg and Leominster and... Then a year or two later, they bring me into the city. That's what they always did back in the day before the newspaper started crashing. They had a whole regional, bunch of regional offices. And I worked my butt off. I'd get out of my little Volkswagen bug. You had to warm them up in the morning before you could drive in the winter, you know. And I'd read a little chapter of a great writing book, 10 Lessons in Something or Other. It's a great book, and if anyone wants it, they can contact me, and I'll show them. But it basically shows you how to use strong verbs, colorful verbs. Write in verbs. Don't just use is all the time. Don't use nouns to speak in. And I took that to heart, and I worked at it, and I got good at it. It would take me like 12 hours to write a story, because you go out and interview someone, then you got all these notes and you're trying to say, how do I consolidate this? You know, how do I get it down? But I'd read the Telegram all my life, you know, so I knew what their style was. And then it was just a matter of doing it and doing it and do it till finally I could get it down to 6 hours. Mm. And then I could get it. So I was there almost 10 years, and then I got a chance to go to Worcester Magazine. By that time, I had been writing music reviews. They put me there because I was a columnist, but, you know, I wrote something about not saluting the flag when I was in high school, and that was the last political column I wrote for them. They said, "Oh, you'd be very good in the music. Why don't you?" So they stuck me, and I covered music, and then I'm going out 3, 4, 5 nights a week, literally. We'd go out, and Val would go out with me, assuming we could get a babysitter. Or actually, this was even before the kids were born, and we'd go and we'd watch a band for 3 songs, and you know in 3 songs whether you're going to like the band or not. So I could see a whole bunch of bands around town, and if you like them, then I'd come back and watch them more, and then I would write about them, and I wouldn't write about the bands that I thought sucked. I didn't think that's fair for a local band.
Yeah.
Unless they were on the big stage somehow. Mm. You know, if they were playing E.M. Lowe's or something, and
like
then
you,
I would do
if
it.
If you were the only one that thought they sucked.
Yeah, many years later, a guy attacked me on Facebook. I mean, many years later.
Really?
For some reason. And I saw he was a friend of Brian Goslow. You know Brian Goslow, right?
Mm-hmm.
and Brian's friends were all in the punk scene very much, yeah. You know. But I became kind of friendly with Brian during the years, and he even wrote for us at Worcester Magazine. But this guy was attacking me, and I said, why is he so hostile? Mm. And he said, well, you wrote that he sang, he had a voice like an angry vacuum cleaner. Then I realized that my words could actually hurt people, you know.
Oh,
jeez.
But,
I mean, he did. He was out there. But he was on the big stage. I didn't do that to the ones I didn't like, you know.
Right.
But during this period of about 9 or 10 years where I was out of bands, I was playing acoustic guitar a lot. We started going to bluegrass festivals with the kids, got into playing in the kitchen with my friends. Then I'm interviewing people, and I find myself asking them, well, how do you do this? Or what makes you, questions about music. Mm. And it got my enthusiasm back into playing when I had been really extremely depressed after breaking up Crockett, even though I did get a job and I was working at the paper. But that's not music.
Yeah.
You know,
that's
not playing music.
Yeah.
And it took me about a year before I would, my friends would be playing in the kitchen and I would make myself come downstairs. But gradually I did, and we started playing. And then getting to talk to people like Ronnie Earl or whoever, anybody, made me see I really want to be doing that again. Mm. And as our kids, we had kids in 83 and 85, and as they got a little bigger, we were able to play a little bit more together. And we started playing. We even played a gig at the Blue Plate with some friends, which under Sugar Mama and the Bad Dads, we packed the place. It was great. It's one of my great things. I had a cordless guitar at that time, and I ran through the crowd while playing Johnny B. Good or something out the front door playing the solo, around to the back door, came in the back door, climbed up on somebody's knee and onto his table, and then onto this ledge that's over the Blue Plate, walked along the ledge and jumped onto the stage.
Wow. So last time I saw you play with Chuck and Mudd, you got up on a table, or no, was I sitting there with Mike?
You were there, it was a shaky table.
It was
you
a
were
shaky
there with
table,
Dan,
and
yes.
We felt like you could have just died. That would could have been it.
It was close. It was close, but I could do that on the day. I can't do that now because the feet won't.
That was only a couple of years ago.
But, yeah, I love to do that kind of stuff. That just kind of pulled us back, and we started playing with our friend Fran McConville, who basically was a fan of the band, and then picked up mandolin, learned to play, and then Bob Dick, the bass player, came along. He had been in this national bluegrass band, Front Range. And this would be like the late 80s, early 90s, and we'd play around with him a little bit. And once he left them and he started playing with us, just in the kitchen and everything, things just worked, you know. So he recorded our first album. He's just a great acoustic bass player and very musical. So two of us standing there in the kitchen playing a song that I wrote or Val wrote would be one thing, and we'd get it together, we'd get the harmonies together, and then Bob would come in and it would take life.
Was this the beginning of Valerie and Walter Crockett and the Oxymorons?
Yes. That it started out just as Valerie and Walter Crockett, and then, you know, we made our first album under that name, and then we added the Oxymorons. We called them the Oxymorons from as soon as there were more than one of them. And shortly after, my daughter had her brain tumor in 91, and she was six. She was a wonderful little active girl, and she got a brain tumor, and they told her she had 6 months to live, It really sucked, but things, you know, she had surgery and was able to get by. She had deficits and chemo and radiation and stuff, but she was able to get back to school and walk with a limp and stuff like that. But the kids missed us playing in the kitchen. They came and said, "You guys don't play enough anymore." So we started playing more, and that got us into the thing with Bob and Franny, And at the same time, I went to Worcester Magazine, and I had to be a co-editor there with Paul Della Valle. That was for 5 years. You know, we were offered a good deal when Alan Fletcher bought Worcester Magazine. They were spending money. They were willing to match our newspaper salaries, and off we go. So I would be going out again, writing music there, and also editing the thing, and writing songs, and dealing with the family stuff. The Val didn't work from that point on, so she was able to take care of. She was Emily's right arm, and I would go to all Jackson's basketball games. But basically, it was an intense songwriting time too, because we got into really playing. We would play the Coffee Kingdom, Troy Tyree's place, Datnick Bookseller, Old Vienna. You know, we would open for acts at Old Vienna at first, and built it up in that way. We just added people. You know, we added Mark Manuel in particular on piano. He could play both piano and banjo, and he's a great piano player. And then we had a full band, and we started playing coffee houses. And Mason Deering picked up our first album that we made, that Bob recorded us. Mason Deering was affiliated with Rounder and did a lot of movies, music for John Sayles with Duke, and Duke told him about us, and he liked it, so we put it out, and that gave us credibility, got us onto WUMB in Boston, and helped us get into the coffee house scene, which was going great at the time. You know, first as openers, and then as headliners in a variety of places. And the good thing about coffee houses was, while the bars, this is at the exact same time that the bars went from having one band playing 3 hours a night and making actual money, and you could make a living in bars, to having three or four bands. This was the Danimal days. And they'd only get paid for the tickets they sold to play at Sir Morgan's Cove, you know, or the Lucky Dog, as they had called it by that time. And when you're one of four bands on stage and you're making no money, and you only get to play once a month, you're not going to get as good as if you're playing a lot, you know. And even if you're not playing a lot, the only way to stay good is to work at it. You gotta do the work. So the quality of local music was not helped by that. But in the folk scene, you could play a little less. I mean, you still had to work, but you had people coming to listen to you, and they were paying $10 a head at the door, you know, and you weren't getting selling 15 tickets and getting $20 or something, you know. And we did that for a while. It was very rewarding. Particularly once you get used to people actually listening to you, you don't have to make them dance anymore. Not that I have anything against people dancing, but that's a different kind of task. You know, if you're playing for dancers in a bar, but when they listen, they're looking right at you. You know, you can't screw up as much. You got to be on the ball, but it becomes addictive, because when you get it right, then they love it, and then they cheer for you, and you get an encore, and you know that they got what you were doing. It was not midnight in the bar and they think anybody's Eric Clapton now.
Yeah.
You know, so that was a wonderful time. We did that for 13 years through four albums, wrote lots of songs in that time. At Worcester Magazine, I'd go out and take a walk up the hill from Shrewsbury Street to the top of that, to Belmont Street, to where the apartments are up there, and then come down and back down to Worcester Magazine's office next to East Park, Columbo Park. I'd write a song, you know. I'd get the process of going up a hill hard would get a song idea into my mind, and I would just sing it kind of over. If I'd get a phrase, I'd tease the phrase out until I get some words, and then I'd see if I could get anywhere. If I had a good candidate, I'd call myself up on the phone and leave a message at work, because I didn't have a cell phone back then.
Oh, yeah. Right? Oh, that's great.
I got a lot of songs like that later on. But so there were just many songs. I'm happy with the songs. And Val wrote some great songs that were characteristic of her, The songs, she sang a lot of songs I wrote, but the songs she sang the best were the ones that she wrote.
Judy grew a wildflower. She's had it since she was a child. She blossomed in the early springtime, and it's driving little Jimmy wild. Now all the girls are jealous of her, except her best friend, Mary Lou. Her mama told her all about it, and she's gonna have a wild one too. Jimmy picked her wildflower, made her with a basketball.
Just fit her. They got her whole personality in there.